You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening for those of us overseas who are attending. Thank you all so much for joining us. My name is Rebecca Winthrop. I am the co-director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution, along with my colleague, Emiliana Vegas. For those of you who don't know of our center, we are focused here in the United States and globally on the mission of making sure that every kid, no matter which community they're born into, gets the skills and competencies they need to thrive in work, life, and citizenship. We are very, very focused on addressing education inequality and quite worried about what we call the 100-year gap, which is that the pace of change in many countries in the world, but also in many parts of the United States, is so slow that it will take about 100 years for the young people who are the most poorly served by education systems to catch up both in attainment and education outcomes to the young people who are best served by education systems. And that is one of the reasons why we were very thrilled to partner with many organizations to form the task force on the Next Generation Community Schools, and particularly because this 100-year gap has been exacerbated by the current moment we are in with the pandemic. And I'm very excited to share with you the findings of the task force report, and then we will open the floor to a conversation with members of the task force and representatives of the Coalition of Community Schools. I'm incredibly grateful to the 22 organizations, the task force members who represent 22 organizations who day in and day out work with families and communities on the ground to help improve education. They were very much involved in the task force report development. This was a group effort. And I also wanted to give a special shout out of thanks to colleagues at New York City's Department of Education at the Office of Community Schools, as well as colleagues at Child Trends who shared with me the leadership of the task force. We are very, very grateful to everybody's inputs and efforts. So now to the main messages coming out of the task force report, which went live yesterday. Really the main recommendation that the task force report is putting forth is that the community schools approach should be scaled nationally, but it should use a progressive universalism approach and start with those communities most impacted by the pandemic with the largest unmet needs. The first finding I want to highlight from the report is that we did a bunch of analysis, many thanks to task force member Bob Balfance at Johns Hopkins University. And the finding is that you could actually focus on a small number of districts, 4% in the analysis we did here, and meet a large number of young people, 40% of the country's young people with the largest unmet needs. And we defined unmet needs as having unmet educational needs prior to COVID, so being off track to graduation, attending schools with very high levels of chronic absenteeism, et cetera, coupled with above average pandemic deaths in the communities. You could play with the formula that we used and come up with 5% or 6% or 2% of school districts. The reason we did this was to illustrate that you don't have to boil the ocean. There are places to focus and reach large number of kids with unmet needs. And I want to point out, we played with this visual over and over. You'll see large blue concentrations in Florida. In the task force report, you'll see that there's basically districts in almost every state in the country, and they include urban and rural communities. And the reason Florida looks so blue here is because they have large geographic districts. So it's a little bit tricky to display, but we think this is a really important finding. The second finding that I want to share with you all is that the task force felt very strongly that community schools approach meets the moment we are in, both because of the strong relationships with parents and families, and the integrated services really is a proven solution to address equity. And in a next generation community school, if you really place teaching and learning in that mix, it really lays the foundation for transforming education in a way that is much needed. So there are seven reasons the task force highlighted that community schools meet the moment. You'll see them here. They center on equity, improves teaching and learning, shares leadership with the community, partners with family, creates a culture of connectedness, accelerates post-secondary success, and incubates innovation. The third finding of the report is really a roadmap. And I put this up to trick you. It's because you can't read it. You're going to have to just go download the report. That's your incentive. But I'll highlight the four steps. It's four steps for scaling community schools nationally. The first step, starting at the bottom there with number one, is for the U.S. administration to galvanize key stakeholders at federal, state, and local levels to scale community schools to places with the greatest need. And of course, where there's interest from communities in the approach. The second recommendation for the second step is to ensure that there's policies and capacity building strategies to broaden the effective implementation of the community schools approach. The third is to innovate to ensure there's a robust research agenda looking at the impacts of next generation community schools. And the last is sustain, which is really around funding, to repurpose and provide funding to initiate and sustain systemic transformation. So that's a snippet of what's in the report. We are now going to move to a conversation with, again, task force members. I'm really pleased to introduce the first keynote conversation. Kicking it off, we are going to have Hema Quetzal, the Next Generation Coalition Chair, representing the Coalition for Community Schools. Hema attended a community school herself in East Oakland, where she grew up. She's now a sophomore at Stanford University, and she will be interviewing John King, who is the president and CEO of the Education Trust, former Secretary of Education of the U.S., and he has been in the trenches. He started out life as, well, not life, but his educational career as a teacher of high school social studies and a middle school principal, and has been deeply committed to education equity issues ever since. So now I'm going to turn it over to you, Hema.
Thank you, Rebecca. So now we're going to have a conversation with John to just have people get an understanding of this recommendation. So this report recommends using the next generation community school approach to address those hardest hit by COVID-19. At the same time, pave a way for a better, more inclusive and relevant teaching and learning model for all students. Could you tell us what is at stake here and why do you think this recommendation is the best way to move forward?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Hema. So, you know, we have to acknowledge that many of the equity challenges we face now were true before COVID. COVID has exacerbated them rather than created them. If we look before COVID, we saw significant inequities at every level of our educational system for low-income students and students of color. Just the sad reality is, as a country, we give the least to the students who need the most. Low-income students and students of color get less access to quality early childhood education, less access to the strongest teachers, less access to advanced coursework, to school counselors, to resources, to support around post-secondary transitions. But then COVID exacerbated all of those challenges. We had a digital divide before COVID, but with schools moving to virtual and hybrid learning, kids who don't have internet access or don't have devices are at a huge disadvantage. We're seeing the consequences of that. Districts that had limited resources really struggled to provide enough support for their teachers. Kids and families that were already vulnerable in our economy before COVID were hit the hardest by the health impact of COVID. We know Black and Latino folks, for example, are three times as likely to die from COVID. Families were hard hit by the economic crisis that COVID brought us. Folks of color and low-income communities experience disproportionate loss of jobs, loss of income, frequent evictions, food insecurity, and hunger. So all of that means that the kids that we are most worried about now are facing these even more daunting circumstances. So community schools are an opportunity to say, communities have to come together in support of our schools to try to address students' needs, that we actually need to partner teachers and principals who are working incredibly hard on behalf of kids with community-based providers, nonprofits, hospitals, healthcare clinics, mental health service providers, folks who work on issues of access to food, access to housing. And if we do that, if we create those kinds of partnerships, we can address the learning loss that COVID has produced. We know from a study, for example, by McKinsey, that we can expect 6 to 12 months of lost learning in math for students of color. It will help us if we build a community school model throughout the country, will help us to address the socio-emotional and mental health toll that COVID has taken on our kids and families that were already vulnerable. And it will help us to, in smart ways, leverage our resources to help families emerge from this period of economic crisis. So there's a lot at stake for the country in making this investment. And fortunately, I think we have in the Biden-Harris administration that recognizes the power that community schools could bring to solving some of our biggest challenges.
Thank you. You mentioned that there's a lot of obstacles a lot of young people face in their education, right? And so there's also going to be big hurdles in implementing these recommendations. So what do you think those hurdles are going to be? And what strategies would you suggest to overcome them?
Yeah, well, you know, three that come to mind right away. One is resources. Unfortunately, our schools that serve our highest need students are often the schools that get the least resources. Still, as a country, we have a school funding system that is too reliant on property taxes, too often resulting in big disparities where we're spending much more on affluent students than we are on the schools that are serving low-income students and disproportionately students of color. And without resources, it's hard to hire the community school's coordinator. And so many times the burden of managing the different partnerships with community-based organizations falls on a principal who's already overwhelmed. And so we need the resources to have that community schools coordinator. We need the resources to have the counselors and mental health service providers on staff at the school to work in conjunction with partner organizations to address kids' needs. Resources, one. A second challenge is the coordination challenge. Unfortunately, in many communities, you have lots of community-based providers who are themselves strapped for resources. Their executive directors are balancing a lot. You have the principal and school district employees, they're balancing a lot. And it's very hard to keep everyone on the same page, to get data sharing agreements done so that folks can intervene at the appropriate moment with families in need of support. So the work on communication is really critical. I like to think about a collective impact model where you bring everyone with a stake in the community together around a table, agree on some common goals. You know, we're going to reduce chronic absenteeism. We're going to increase high school graduation rates. We're going to increase matriculation to community colleges and four-year colleges in our region. And then they work together collaboratively, meeting regularly to make sure that their efforts are coordinated. And then the third challenge is we still have to do school really well. And sometimes what happens when we talk about community schools, we talk about all the wraparound supports and we don't focus enough attention on the instructional core. And at the end of the day, if we want kids to make academic progress, they've got to experience really great teaching. We've got to invest in teacher professional development. We've got to invest in high quality curriculum materials. We've got to help teachers create lessons that are engaging and compelling and interesting. So if we do those things, if we do that academic piece well, then all the wraparound supports, all the other elements of the community school process can really supercharge our results.
Yes, thank you. Those obstacles are super real. Resources, coordination, communication, and academics. How do we make sure that we're implementing these in a way that we're really including the whole community in a very positive way that overcomes these things? And, you know, a lot of people are going to be looking at these recommendations, right? Aside from policymakers, educators, and administrators, students, families, and their communities are going to read this report, right? So what do you hope is their biggest takeaway from this report?
Well, I hope that they see the emphasis on partnership and that this report really calls on folks who are doing community schools work to partner with families, with community-based institutions, with faith-based institutions, right? This is really a call to partnership and to listening. And, you know, too often in public policy, what happens is researchers and policymakers decide they know what the right answer is and impose it on communities. This is really a call to say, no, the solutions here have to be generated in partnership with community. We need to have parents and family members at the table helping folks understand what do they need, what services will be helpful to their kids' success. What are the challenges in communicating with different service providers in the community? And so I hope people see that, and I hope people hold school districts and community schools efforts accountable for delivering on that. You know, in some communities, the big obstacle to accessing services is translation and making sure that there are enough bilingual staff at the school and at various partner organizations to work effectively with communities. That's not something that's optional. That is the responsibility of school districts and their partners to make sure they address that. And so I want parents to be demanding of the institutions to serve our kids as well as possible.
Yes, thank you for that. Really emphasizing the fact that community schools, it's in the name itself, right? Community. And community is partnership. So how do we work together to really implement that and hold each other accountable? Those are all the questions I have for you. Would you like to say anything else?
Yes. Well, I have a question for you. I'd love to hear from you what your experience has been. Where have you seen community schools working to create safe, supportive environments for students and families?
Yes, well, I grew up in East Oakland, and I am a product of Oakland Unified School District, which is a community school district, right? And in that community schools, I got to meet a lot of people who are parent and family engagement liaisons, student engagement liaisons, community coordinators. And something I saw often was the fact that, you know, they were reaching out to the community, not only asking, what do you need, but how do we work together and actually creating that action to go forward with that. And I feel like that's the amazing thing about community schools is that you're not only trying to ask what you need, you're implementing those things together and also asking students and including students. Because often traditional schools, they may only concentrate on the academics. But as we know, academics is not the only thing in a student's life. And as someone who grew up in East Oakland, we know there's a lot of challenges that young people face. And so how do we make sure that this young person, we're listening to them and seeing what issues they're facing and really addressing those issues and also building community at the same time? And community is really at the center of it all. It's really about support. And really making sure that even after they graduate, they're not only college ready, but life ready, and they have a support system going forward in their life. And I think that's the great thing about community schools.
That's really inspiring. Well, thank you for the conversation and thanks for sharing your experience.
Yes, thank you so much for this conversation as well. I would like to give it back to Rebecca.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Hema. And thank you so much, John, for kicking us off. I would like to now invite onto the screen our panelists who I will introduce. So please come bring your videos up. We're going to have a discussion with four task force members as well as Coalition of Community Schools rep. We have Sarah Jonas, who might want to wave if people don't see her name there, who's the Executive Director of the Office of Community Schools for New York City's Department of Education. We have Jamie Lawley, Community School Manager, Oakland Unified School District, and representative of the Coalition of Community Schools. We have Jeannie Oakes, who is the presidential professor emeritus of educational equity from UCLA and senior fellow in residence for the Learning Policy Institute, and Ray Saldana, president and CEO of Communities in Schools. So all of you, thank you so much. And you may unmute yourselves. I wanted to first turn it over to you, Jeannie, because you have been one of the leading gurus on as a researcher and an academic defining what a community school approach is. And I thought maybe we should take a step back, for we have lots of people joining us and not everybody might know, you know, what is a community school exactly? The task force report leaned in on saying a community school approach needs four pillars, which you had defined. Could you tell us a little bit about what makes a community school and why those four pillars are so important?
Sure, thank you. And it's a real treat to be with all of you today. You know, community schools are both a place and an approach to doing schooling. And that approach is based on evidence-based principles. It's not just a program that you bring in and implement the same way people elsewhere have implemented. And it's certainly far more than a sign above the door of the school that says we're a community school. So the four pillars are all, and it's important to think about all pillars as working synergistically. So they really support each other. The first is the one that's probably most familiar to most people, which is integrated student supports. So that means that schools become centers where kids and families can access mental and physical health care, nutrition support, housing assistance, and other wraparound services. But it's also three other pillars. The second pillar is expanded and enriched learning time. So this includes both longer school days or school years, as well as enriching the curriculum through real world learning opportunities. And that's a very important part of it, that, as John said, that it's the teaching and learning is at the core as well. A third pillar is active family and community engagement. And that includes both service provision, but also meaningful partnerships with parents and family members to support children's learning. And finally, and this may be the glue that helps hold a community school together, is that it's collaboratively led, and there are collaborative practices, including coordination of community school services, as well as site-based leadership teams and teacher learning communities. So together, these four pillars mean that it's more than wraparound services, and certainly it's not a deficit approach that thinks about, well, let's just provide all these services for these needy kids. It certainly does provide services. But in community schools, every family and community member is a partner in the effort to build on students' strengths, to engage them in learners and enable them to reach their full potential. So research, it's important to know that research finds that when well-designed and fully implemented, community schools increase student success and reduce gaps in both opportunity and achievement. And they do this through the pillars, but also because they create more positive school climates and create trusting relationships among adults and children that are crucial for learning. So now let me just say one more thing, is that while community schools are particularly effective in communities of concentrated poverty, where very few families and neighborhoods are able to supplement what traditional schools provide, but the approach is not designed only for schools in low-income communities. In fact, the approach can be used to establish and sustain best practices in any school. In fact, many schools in more advantaged communities already have many of the features of community schools.
Thanks, Jeannie. There was a question that came in that asked about how community schools can help solve a conundrum where academics is pitted against social emotional learning and health and well-being of students. And I think you basically answered that question. I was going to ask it, but thank you ahead of time. Ray, I want to turn to you. And really sort of the main question I want to ask you, based on your whole experience with community schools, is why community schools are well positioned to meet the moment we're in and address education inequality. That was a big finding and argument of the task force. First off, if you wouldn't mind, you grew up in Texas, you attended a high school that partnered with Community Schools, which is the organization you now run. I would be really interested if you could tell us a little bit about your experience.
Well, first, let me start by describing a great coincidence. It was so great that Hema Katzal was interviewing former Secretary John King, and that she's a sophomore at Stanford, but also started at a community school. I was a sophomore in high school when I met communities in schools, also ended up at Stanford. I'm not saying community schools is a pipeline to Stanford, but it just so happened in this coincidence. I know that in my situation, but for the support of my relationship with the on-based school site coordinator, who was implementing what Professor Oakes just described, which was integrated student supports, which was one of the reasons she found me, which was one of the reasons Communities and Schools found the school that I was in. Hema talked about this. I'll just elevate this a little more. I grew up on the south side of San Antonio, which, you know, if you're a researcher and if you've looked at those census tracts and zip codes and neighborhoods that oftentimes suffer from generational poverty, I don't necessarily look at that as a statistic. That is the neighborhood I grew up in. That's where my family and friends now live. It's where I'm calling you. It's where I'm doing this call from now. And what we know about the probabilities, the barriers, the obstacles that students in these communities deal with really requires a proportionate response. And what I think is just incredible about this moment is that I also should mention that I feel honored to be on this call and following up Professor Oakes, because I was reading her research as a graduate student myself. But in this moment, we're not just reading the research, we're talking about how to implement on a wide scale. And because of the experience over the last 12 months, it's not just academia who's having this conversation or public education, it's outside those bubbles to folks who feel an angst about what we can do to truly combat this suffocating environment that we have for a lot of our young people living in the communities of generational poverty and what we could do about it, especially in our case in the sphere of public education. The task force on the next generation of community schools has sort of outlined a real playbook for us to rethink and redesign a way of supporting our principals and our teachers, because you talked about this pitting of academic versus social emotional or non-academic. When that is everybody's job, it is no one's job. And so if that is the job of our teachers or our principals, it tends to lose its focus. And that's why when I met Communities and Schools, really what I was meeting is I was meeting Mrs. Reyes. And she was covering a lot of those important things that I needed to access college, to find financial aid, to afford the fees for tests that I needed to take. And it was even that relationship that I used after high school to continue to work with my site coordinator. At the end of the day, I want to reiterate this. It's not programs that are changing students' lives, they're relationships. That's what has made this particular strategy, backed by evidence and research, a resilient strategy, not just for COVID relief or to reopen schools, but to keep them open in a more just future. So that's been my experience, and I'm grateful to get to lead now as a product of the program of Communities and Schools, now the president and CEO of an organization, and we are partnering with 2,900 schools all across the country implementing integrated student supports.
And do you want to say just a little bit more about Communities and Schools? Because that was a really good sort of primer on why they matter and how the approach can work. You know, a couple of key things you have on your agenda or how your experience has shaped your vision for the organization?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as we think about what it truly means to be in this moment and why Communities and Schools and Community Schools Next Generation movement matters, is because you think about who is using them. In this moment, the Communities and Schools were operating in 29 states. I say that we're in 2,900 schools. At the beginning of the pandemic, we're in 2,500. So our principals, our superintendents were making decisions about who they could partner with that would have the greatest impact on attendance, on dropout prevention, on our ability to get our families connected to housing and to food pantries. And coordinating all those resources can sometimes, it takes a PhD in some communities. And we're in rural, urban, and suburban communities that we have a trained site coordinator. And that is the magic of Communities and Schools. It's those 3,500 site coordinators that are deployed all across the country. that really makes this work. And so we're excited about what this means to redefine the support systems for schools and entire institutions that have been built really inequitably suffering in this environment.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Ray. Jamie, I'd like to turn to you because Ray talked about how important trusting relationships are. And you are the, Mrs. Reyes for your students. Ray talked about Mrs. Reyes being the having the equivalent of your job. So I would love to hear, my main question for you is, what does it take on the ground to implement a community schools approach? It'd be great if you could tell us a little bit first about Oakland Unified School District. We heard from Hema, which is one of your graduates. She's a pretty good advertisement, by the way. Tell us a little bit about your school, about your district, and then tell us, about what you do every day to make this all come together.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I am thrilled to follow Hema, obviously. She is an amazing daughter of Oakland. And I am here representing Oakland Unified and my school, Frick United. So Oakland is about an 80 school, urban district in Northern California. We are proud to be the town. And we support students who and families who in a community that suffers from a lot of inequity. And so our job, our goal is to create equitable schools. So our tagline, our mission is community schools and thriving students. And so we understand, given our population, that it does take more in certain places to make sure those needs are met. So we have 41 community school managers in our district. 80 schools, 41 community school managers. So it does mean that they are deployed at the highest need school. So it's literally an equity-based solution to so many things that are happening. Let's take my school, Frick United, for instance. We have an amazing community. And I'm proud to be able to sit here in this space and in support of our community. But we do have challenges. We have a significant population that are newcomer students, special education students. We're a 100% Title I school. We've got a lot of folks who are food insecure, housing insecure. All of these things, of course, were exacerbated by COVID-19. And so there's a lot to be done, a lot of work to be done to make sure that all of those needs are met in ways that the family can really respond to, right? It necessitates work here at the school site, but it also means it has to be not just a district-wide approach, it's a city-wide approach. Like, this is how we do schools in Oakland. Like, this is what we do and how we do it. And that's really important. I think some of those things named as challenges can become opportunities as well. So we have a rich community, which allows us to have different lenses on how we think about handling solutions to problems that we may face. Ray talked about like language, like there's so many languages that are here in our schools. That was John who talked about it. And it means that we have the infrastructure and we create infrastructures around what could be a challenge and create an opportunity. So we do that in Oakland, but the work on the ground is held by persons like myself. I'm a community school coordinator. I'm proud to be a community school coordinator here in Oakland. And in describing the role, it is a relational role. Relationships matter. This is people work. It will always be people work. And that's just important to always remember. Our families trust us with their best, which is their children, and trust us to fix sometimes the worst situations that can happen. And if you do not have relationships with families, if they do not trust you, they will never come to you as a solution. And so it really means that you are in listening mode very often that you have a growth mindset about what our families and our communities can do and what they can accomplish always. It's not like not a deficit mindset. Like, we know how amazing these communities are, but it takes someone who's willing to sit in relationship with families. Like, we sit with them as we help them through the work. And when we do that, we help navigate them to solutions. It could be a program, it could be a service, it could be something far larger than that. We really help to make sure that we are leveraging like the resources that we have, limited though they are, to the maximum. So we do that with partnerships, we do that with parents, with our students, to really see the assets that we have in our community. But we really aim to leverage those limited resources in support of students, to help students and families thrive. And that really does take some finesse. It takes time, but it does take this position. So it is really, really an important aspect of making community schools work. And so hopefully that gives you a little bit of a snippet of how we get this done here in Oakland.
Yes, it does. Thank you. Thank you so much. And it reminds me so much of all the literature, given that I sit at Brookings and we pour over research day in, day out on what it takes to make real family school partnerships. And, you know, you're basically reiterating what all the studies say, which is a trusting relationship between schools and families is the foundation. Sarah, I wanted to turn to you. I know New York City has done a lot of work on community schools, and in conversation with yourself and various other colleagues, you have said that relationship that the community schools had with the communities and families was essential for enabling them to quickly respond in COVID and really make that pivot to get to the real needs of their students and their families. Could you just, you know, my big question for you is about how schools could you give some examples about how schools have stepped up amid COVID and why that model helped do that? You know, first, perhaps for people who don't know, just set the scene a little bit about community schools approach and how it's used in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Rebecca. And again, I'm so proud to be here representing New York City as the executive director of the Office of Community Schools. We are the nation's largest community schools initiative. By this fall, we'll have 300 schools that will be serving over 150,000 students and families. And we've worked really hard to ensure, as everyone has said here, that we're really placing this work at the heart of our district's commitment to advancing equity and advancing equity now. And as I think about this work, you know, there's sort of four kind of key factors in terms of how this has been able to grow. You know, it hasn't grown overnight to this size and scale. I think, you know, the strong leadership has been really important. Absolutely placing the highest of value on relationships, as everyone here has talked about, a commitment to an accountability to results, and really building a strong infrastructure to support this work. And I'll just say that we've been, you know, really privileged to have Mayor de Blasio and our Chancellor Carranza, who have vocally supported this work. It made me think about, you know, earlier when Mayor de Blasio was campaigning, he really listened to families that were calling for more community schools. And he responded to that by committing to and pledging to growing 100 new community schools during his campaign, as well as committing to investing city resources into growing this work. And our chancellor has been equally supportive and vocal about, you know, the value of this work and the value of the partnerships and the trust to really advance, you know, success for young people through a community school strategy. In fact, just this morning, I saw an email about a visit that our chancellor had made to one of our community schools. It's a middle school that was reopening today, and really calling out that partnership and that relationship and that trust that's really creating that welcoming environment for students and families. And certainly the leadership and relational trust that our principal have built, you know, as community school principals in partnership with community school directors. And during COVID, I think, you know, without a question, the trust has been the single most important factor to community schools being able to step up powerfully during the pandemic, and not only, you know, to be able to identify what you know, the real needs are of students and families, like Jamie was saying, but through that relationship, being able to actually address those needs and to create healing spaces, which has been really important during this time as well, like those welcoming and healing spaces. So I'll just give two really quick examples among many. One that comes to mind is our community school director, Allison Brown, who works in Brooklyn. And in her community school, she was able to work with her community to address food insecurity in a number of really creative ways. One of which was actually using and repurposing a hair salon that had been closed during the pandemic. And she learned about this through a family, and they were able to repurpose that hair salon as a food packaging and distribution center for the community. Another great example is our community school director, Jessica Mazzo, who was able to collaborate with school staff and leadership and families to create a video series called Wellness Wednesdays. And this became a safe space for families to work together and share, and get advice about how to support students' social and emotional needs and well-being during quarantine, which we know has been really difficult for all students and, you know, particularly for adolescents who are missing some of that connection. So being able to get that support in that space was really successful and powerful.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Ginny, there's a couple of questions that have come in that I wanted to pose to you because they're about the teaching and learning piece of community schools. And you talked about, as did John, sort of a next generation approach is really inserting that teaching and learning piece. We have someone who has asked, let me find it. This is from Amy. She's asked, how can we community schools support such pedagogical approaches like service learning? And there's another question, which I think is very interesting, is from Heather, who's a social studies teacher, and says, what advice would you give to teachers trying to bring these ideas into their classrooms? You know, they want to integrate a community schools approach ideas into their classrooms and into schools, but this, you know, in a context where the school board and an administrator does not consult with teachers nor parents and students. So, you know, could you talk a little bit about the sort of teaching and learning component? You know, you've talked a lot in the past about how the learning sciences support the community schools approach for whole child development and answer some of those questions in the process.
Sure. great questions. I think one of the things that's striking, even though community schools is a 100-year-old strategy, it really was born out of the thinking of Jane Addams and John Dewey, and Dewey was really focused on creating learning environments. And here we are, more than 100 years later, seeing community schools as being extraordinarily well-positioned to enact the knowledge that's coming out of the learning sciences and the knowledge about child and youth development. And that's because community schools actively engage students as learners by blurring the lines between school and community and by offering rigorous project-based curricula and culturally responsive pedagogy that connects to students' lived experiences. So during the traditional day, as well as after school and expanded learning time, students can identify, and here's an social studies teachers are very well positioned to do this, but students can identify real world issues that are affecting their neighborhoods and work together with teachers and families and community partners to design and implement projects that connect what's being taught in the classroom to the surrounding community. And what's nice is that they have experts there in the form of the community adults that are also part of the school. So it's not teachers having to cross over and learn about a community that they don't know, perhaps, but rather because they're already in partnership. And I'd like to give you one example that's in the report that I think is truly wonderful, partly because it's a UCLA example, but also because it's an example of teaching and learning, really next generation teaching and learning that happened during the COVID lockdown. That one of the UCLA community schools is one of the poorest, most heavily impacted community around COVID in Los Angeles. And what the school did is they quickly adapted to the virtual environment by engaging students, by having them read articles and data and looking at videos and to do research to explore the disparate impact of COVID-19 on people of color and people in poor communities. And they used street maps and data to dig into the issues around the local environment and what could be, how these factors were coming together. And it's really interesting because recent research on learning really suggests that education experiences that use these kind of innovative pedagogical approaches really do help develop both the cognitive and the lifelong learning skills and competencies needed to thrive in today's world. And I think one of the major ways it does that is it really integrates the cognitive development with the social and emotional learning by having kids connected to their own experiences.
Great, thank you. That's the merging, not pitting apart. It's true that it's if one of the messages we could get out, you know, through this and many other avenues is that social emotional competence breeds academic success, and it's not a mutually exclusive zero sum game. That will be incredibly helpful. There's another question that has come in, and Jamie, I wanted to address it to you. It's come from Alejandro, and he is saying that he's really looking at, he works in a school, he's looking at the summer coming up and wondering, will the community schools approach be helpful in utilizing summer hours for helping kids catch up?
I think absolutely, because one of the things that's a hallmark of a community school is expanded learning. Expanded learning can happen before school, it can happen after school, and it definitely includes summer learning. It's an amazing time, space, and opportunity to really support students. We know that there are significant learning losses happening in COVID, and depending on where you sit in the country, there's different access to in-person education. So if that is an availability that Alejandro has, please, please, please do make use of it. Summer's also this really amazing space to innovate. And that is something that is one of the task force recommendations, like it's a space of being of innovation. Summer is like this time where you get to try on new programs to see how students respond to them. Do they enjoy them? Do they really have the impact that we think they will? And to plan for scaling up, right? You sometimes pilot something in the summer and see how we can scale up full school, full district, and it gives a perfect time and space to do that. And I think if you're looking at summer, it's a perfect place to start for pivoting back to a new reality that we're facing and that we're going to have to go into next year. So I think Alejandro's on the right track in knowing that summer is a great time to get this work started.
Great, thanks, Ray. There's a question that's come in that I'd like to address to you. It's from Lisa. And she's asked, and I want to address it to you because Communities in School works at the policy level. You work across the nation. And she's specifically asking about the Biden administration. And she's wondering if it would be important to encourage the Biden administration to foster interdepartmental collaboration between education, health, human services, and housing, et cetera, to model this sort of integrated approach at the federal level. I'm curious if you think that would be helpful or if you think that's just an impossible long shot. What's your take?
Well, let me start here. I'm a former elected official. I used to be on the San Antonio City Council, served there for 8 years. What the Biden administration has said is that they want to build back to better. And if you truly believe that, and they have really lifted up equity as a cornerstone of what this administration hopes to achieve, if you truly care about that, you have to confront a few realities. Again, as a former elected official, I know that there is not an infinite amount of resources to be deployed to solve this problem, but you also have to confront that history has taught us certain lessons about the way these institutions, specifically public education, have been built. And I hope this is not controversial to say, but they haven't been built for everyone, especially for communities of color, especially for students who are Black or brown, students like Hema or I who are living in these communities where we have to overcome so many obstacles just to get to a level playing field with the rest of our peers. So if you truly care about that, there has to be a way to approach public education. We believe that the task force has set aside a strategy that Professor Oak said has been around for 100 years. Believe me, this is what well-resourced communities have been doing and are continuing to do and will continue to do in the future. And one of the recommendations that I would point to folks in this research is that Bob Balfans from Johns Hopkins, you talked about it, said, how can we have an outsized impact without infinite resources and target that approach? In this case, 4% of school districts that represent 40% of the students that we really truly need to serve, to use former Secretary King's term, those are the highest need often get the least. So how do we reverse this? And we think that the Biden administration has at least nodded to this concept that we have already piloted at communities and schools. The community schools as a movement understands that this is going to be about braiding funding from the Department of Education, from state level legislation, because we have examples at communities and schools where we have legislatures in Texas, in Ohio, in West Virginia, who are saying, you know, let's not just wait for the federal government to come in and help us build what we know is better for our schools and the least among us in terms of the students. Let's build it ourselves. So you have an approach where you have local dollars in some cases, federal dollars, we hope, through the Biden administration to support this. As a member of the task force, I learned about the Full Service Community Schools Act that is being deliberated. So I think there is momentum. And if you're truly serious about this, you have to confront the reality that we have to start with those communities with the highest need. And we have to confront our history that we need to build back a system with the ingredients that Professor Oakes described, which the research is behind. And we at Community Schools, tested and evaluated as a national nonprofit, know works in communities all across this country.
Great, thanks. Before I have a final question for all of you, which picks up on exactly what Ray started talking about, which is what we need to do to scale community schools. And Ray, you already answered a question that somebody sent in around funding, like this, how are we going to tackle, how can community schools be effective use of dollars, because they deliver on multiple outcomes. But before we do that, there's a question that's just come in from Jeff, and I would like you sort of just top of your mind, whatever comes out, you know, one sentence, answer it. We'll do a round robin. And he basically says, community schools are so logical. What is the primary hindrance to shifting to schools acting this way as the norm? Sarah, top of mind.
Sure.
What's the
top
primary hindrance, barrier?
I would say largely a mindset shift. I think it's just a different way of doing schooling. And I think, you know, historically schools have tended to operate somewhat in isolation, and this idea of actually partnering directly with communities and sort of co-leading and co-imagining and co-creating education is just a mindset shift that we've already started making, as you've heard about here today. And I would say that that's, you know, the place to kind of lean in even more deeply into the work for success.
Jeannie, what's your initial gut reaction, biggest hindrance?
I'd go back to something John said too about resources. It's about resources and it's about infrastructure. Giving a little startup grant to a school, assuming that if they have a little bit of money for a year, then they can somehow continue to provide this comprehensive approach, is just, it's full of flaws. If we really believe in this approach as what public schooling should be, they need to have steady and reliable resources. But the second is they need opportunities to learn. Because if you give money to somebody and say, be a community school, and the people there have no opportunities to learn from others about how you do community schools, you'll never get to the mindset shift that Sarah was talking about. It's not as though people know how to do this automatically. It's the adults need opportunities to learn as well.
Jamie?
I think I echo what my other panelists have said, but I also think that it seems like such a heavy lift. Mm. And when there's so much going on in schools and there's so many demands, and there's especially for principals, I think they look at all of what a community school can accomplish and think that they have to be there immediately without knowing that you can start small. There are core elements, there are core components that many schools are doing inherently. And there's small shifts you can make on a continuum, but it seems like such a heavy lift when so much is already demanded. And that isn't the case. You can start with some really, really key behaviors and activities to get the ball rolling.
That's great. Ray.
Hindrance. Yeah, let me come. I think it's two things. I think it is short-term memories and our reflex to just have a sugar rush, which is, you know, I've got to think about something that'll work quickly, that will work within a 2 or 4 year election cycle. And what we're talking about here is shifting power to communities without power so they can power themselves. That's a long-term generational transition. And we shouldn't be looking for any easy buttons here. Again, building relationships is not something you do on a 3-year funding cycle. it's important that policymakers know that this doesn't need to be boutique. It has already been piloted. It's gone through 2 decades worth of research. And we need to think long-term.
And Ray, I'll start with you then on, you know, I want to give each of you sort of parting words on scaling. You know, you've really, you sort of laid it out, you know, policymakers need to know it doesn't need to be boutique. Can you talk about sort of state and federal level? What do you think are the most important things that should happen next to try to scale this approach?
Well, I think the conversation that Hema and Secretary King brought up was important, which was ask the community and they will tell you in many cases what the answers are to their context. And for us, what we've recognized at the state level, especially, is that those policymakers who are looking around for what we do to really heal this angst, this social, this economic justice, the social justice and this racial justice doesn't need to be overcomplicated. And if the best thing to do, you know, I think about this concept that the best time to plant an oak tree is 50 years ago, the next best time is today. We knew in 2013, the statisticians will check this, that public schools and the population of students who are in these public schools crossed the threshold of being over 50% students living in poverty. We have just not transitioned the system to support them quick enough. But this is going to be something that we all have to lift at the state and the federal level, and nobody goes it alone. And that's the important concept of this new generation of community schools.
Great. Thanks, Ray. Sarah, could you, you know, answer that question around scaling, particularly for your peers in cities? What are kind of the next steps a city could do if they would want to replicate an Oakland Unified or a New York City School District approach to community schools?
Sure. Well, and I definitely think like that prior conversation about sort of, you know, how can we afford to do this? Like my mind is like, how can we afford not to do this? Right. And so we know that community schools is an efficient and effective way to use existing resources, you know, to repurpose and attract new resources to this work. So I think that's a really like important kind of piece to lift up here. I also think that what we've talked about being community driven is really central, right? So for like any city that's looking to do this, again, you know, how do you do this in concert with a wide range of stakeholders, students, families, community members, you know, community-based organizations, educators, other sectors, you know, health and human services sectors, how do you work together to really build a collective platform for the vision for community schools for your city? It takes, I think, that level of you know, kind of buy-in and championship at sort of a cross-stakeholder level. I think that that's really critical to a successful initiative that's based on a collective vision.
Great. Thank you. Jeannie, what about you? You are also sitting in New Mexico. We haven't mentioned New Mexico.
I know. Well, and New Mexico does have a statewide Community Schools Act, and the legislature's in session right now and trying to decide how to best scale community schools. This is such a state with such need. But I think one of the secrets, and it's very hard, is to figure out how to develop policy that's tight enough so you don't have anything goes as a community school. So you really do ensure that people are following the evidence about the importance of the four pillars, but that also the policy is loose enough so you're not prescribing exactly what it is people do in each of those pillars, so that each community can work together to build on their strengths and to address their needs. So this sort of tight, loose policy that we really need to figure out how to develop.
Great. Jamie, last word to you. Of course, you cannot, as many people have said, roll out and scale up a community schools approach by fiat and dictate sitting from some office somewhere. It's the communities themselves who have to be interested and buy in and participate. So, what would you say to people about how we have to make sure to keep those voices at the table?
Well, I would say it would be by keeping folks like me at the table, right? So we are the holder of relationships with our family so that we're able to go and listen and sit and make sure we understand what the current needs for the families are. There needs to be sustained funding for folks like me. There has to be sustained funding for community school coordinators nationally, because with that and the training that should go along with it, so that we're doing the work as intended, that we are able to scale up so we can learn as a district. You can build on that. But if the sustainable funding isn't there for positions like myself, then those people leave and the relationships aren't as strong. They may take that trust away with them. And so we want our families to know that they have a Mrs. Reyes, a Mrs. Lolly, like all those people have to be in the schools, because sometimes when those people go, the families go, and it just destabilizes the community. So it's really important for community school coordinators to be a position that is funded for the long term.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all so much. And I just am very grateful for your time. I want to, for our audience members, as we wrap up here, give another shout out to all the task force members. If you want more information, you can check our Brookings website. You'll find the report there, the executive summary, but also in the report is the list of all the task force members and their organizations. You can check them all out. And then the next Center for Universal Education event that we have coming up is on March 16th, is on reporting back from a parent survey of 25,000 parents around the world, including across the U.S., with our Family Engagement and Education Network, where we're looking at beliefs, perceptions, trust of parents with their schools. So with that, I want to thank everybody for attending, and I hope you have a good rest of your day.